Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Insight into Healing. My name is Alexa Servadidio, and I am your host. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Through the last couple of weeks, I've been doing shows with a lot of guests concerning all different topics of the International Day of Peace, faith, God, your spiritual journey to Ebola, and terrorism. So I've decided to come back and do a show just with myself, answering questions from the listeners, and really going into a lot of different topics. I've been getting a lot of questions concerning anorexia and bulimia, body image distortion, and about, you know, self-image and how to feel about yourself. So let's start with the first question. Dear Insight into Healing, what is the difference between anorexia and bulimia? I actually was just doing a study on eating disorders from the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America, put out a manual, Eating Disorders, Signs, Symptoms, and Management. So I've gotten a lot of statistics and information, too, from AFA. So I'll be going back and forth reading different definitions and then also my personal experience with eating disorders in my private practice and in the clinic that I work in. So those who suffer from anorexia and bulimia struggle with body image distortion. However, when you're anorexic, it's more the distortion of your body is more severe. This says anorexia sufferers pursue thinness without regard to our acknowledgement of their possible emaciation and malnourishment. What this means is they don't see themselves that skinny. They don't have the ability to look in the mirror and realize that they're so emaciated, that they're so malnourished, that they're so thin. What they see is someone who's overweight, someone who doesn't have control over their life. And I think that's what becomes so dangerous with bulimia and with anorexia, is what you really look at in the mirror, what you see and what is reality are two different things. And it becomes your distortion of what you see and how you feel really takes over your thoughts of your mind and your behavior, and can also be very severe, leading into death, leading to severe medical issues. Psychologically, anorexics have an intense irrational fear of growing fat. They fear an inability to control elements of their lives centering around food. This also I find a lot with working with clients. Usually I say that when I see something with an eating disorder, I want to rule out sexual abuse. I also want to look for any cutting behaviors because sometimes they can be associated with it. So I would definitely look at that. I would also be looking at what are their eating habits, were there any triggers. This book also says that, you know, anorexia usually begins with a diet. They start as going on a diet, they're feeling that they're a little overweight, they want to have control over what's going on, and then it takes a very drastic turn, especially when a lot of these young girls that have these eating disorders do it around puberty, when their bodies are changing, when they're growing. So what becomes very serious is this can affect their menstrual cycle, this can affect their growth and how their body is growing and developing. And then the dieting serves as an area of their life that this person feels they can control. They start to feel better about themselves. They start to say, okay, I can finally control this. So it feeds the anorexia feeds them mentally, emotionally, not physically, to feel control, to feel like they have some power over their life. Especially, you know, when young girls or even young boys suffer from eating disorders, they have this feeling of maybe the world is chaotic, maybe there's trauma in the house, maybe there's abuse, there's addiction, there's other things going on that they're feeling that they can't control, things are just happening. So this usually will start to also trigger the eating disorder. And I think it's also is up there with the cutting behavior. Cutting, too, is usually when there's feelings of not being in control, feeling a lack of power, feeling overwhelmed, feeling a lot of pain, and not being able to release this immense pain that they're feeling. So by cutting or controlling their food intake or over-exercising, or when we go into what bulimia is, purging, vomiting, causing themselves to rid of the negativity, becomes very, very serious. And says, as body images become more distorted, this person may never perceive his or her body as it actually is or what it's become. That's what's so serious. When they look in the mirror, they can be with 50 pounds, 60 pounds, very emaciated, almost death, looking like deadly, looking like a skeleton, and they will still see an overweight person. They will see that a fat person. So I think that's what's really dangerous with eating disorders. If you yourself suffer from eating disorder or you suspect somebody, it's very important to get professional help. An eating disorder, this is not something, again, you want to do on your own. This also has a lot of serious medical issues associated with it through time, depending how long this person has been suffering from an eating disorder. But you definitely need doctors, you need team, you need inpatient to really help this person suffering from anorexia too or bulimia to get back on the right path, and also to learn new eating habits. And also, just even getting healthier eating habits is not going to help this person too. I think what really needs to help is changing and really working on their thoughts, their automatic thought pattern, obviously a negative automatic thought pattern, and really to explore that with them, see what triggered it, see if there's any abuse history, see what's going on, when did this start, when did this feeling of not being in control, and what can this person do moving forward when they're not feeling in control of something, when they're feeling overwhelmed, when they're feeling there's chaos around them, so they don't kind of relapse back into this eating disorder. It says anorexia is found most frequently among middle to upper class white female adolescents, and anorexic carries 19 to 1 female to male ratio and affects about 1% of the adolescent female population. Approximately 1 out of every 200 women is anorexic. Now that's pretty huge, and I think, you know, we all you know, worry about body weight, about, you know, being healthy, exercising. But I think sometimes it becomes too much. Also looking at the lack of self-confidence, and I think it happens a lot when you're an adolescent, a young adulthood. You have those pressures to look good, to fit in, also your self-confidence, you're building up to who you are. So it's very tough. It's really a hard time in these young person's life that where an eating disorder can come in. And it said, most anorexic girls tend to be very rigid thinkers, dealing with life in the extreme. This, coupled with the self-report by many anorexics of feeling they have no control over their lives, is enough for many to go to extreme measures to find some area of their lives which they can control totally. That's really definitely a scary, scary thought. And I think it's really being, if you know someone or you're feeling like something is out of control, again, to get help. Symptoms: excessive weight loss. Over the course of months or even years, a person may lose weight in extremes. Often anorexia is identified by loss of more than 25% of body weight. Hair, nail, and skin problems, lack of necessary nutrients in the diet may lead to dull, stringy hair, possibly even hair loss, as well as scaly skin and brittle nails. Cessation of menstruation. Rigid dieting greatly reduces female hormone levels, disrupting the menstrual cycle. Extreme sensitivity to cold temperatures. The loss of muscle and fat makes it difficult for the body to retain heat, and body hair growth. This one I didn't know about. This is very interesting. Often fine hair may begin to grow on the body in effort to retain heat. It really makes sense when you're thinking about this. The person is losing so much weight, they're losing the nutrients, everything that keeps them warm, that the hair starts to grow to kind of protect the body, to keep the heat in, to help the person, you know, stay alive. And they said a lot of treatment is treatment of the medical problems, nutritional support and re-education, mental health counseling and therapy, and also can be medication, depending on how serious this is going. And I think also finding out what triggered this. What is it? And I think anorexia is not just about food. It's about something else going on. This is more than just a physical. It's a mental, it's emotional and physical. So I think you really need, as I've covered a lot on my other shows, is you really have to go through all different areas, physically, emotionally, mentally, and explore each one. And there's no time limit. It takes time to really go through this. It's not going to be an overnight change, I think it's going to be a process. This is a lifestyle change for this person to not be anorexic, to not be bulimic, to really change their view of eating or not eating, of control of everyday life, being around other people who eat, going to restaurants. It becomes very, very serious. Now, bulimia is an eating disorder in which the sufferer binges or consumes large amounts of food in a relatively small amount of time, and then purges, vomiting, ridding the body of the food. The purging is most often in the form of self-induced vomiting, but may take the form of laxative abuse too, diuretic, water pills, excessive exercising, fasting, or any combination of all these methods. And I think that the act of binging and purging is usually kept secret. This is not something that they are telling other people that they are, you know, saying, hey, this is what's going on. It's usually very private. I think you can also, sometimes you might see someone after they have a large meal, they go into the bathroom right away. Not saying that everyone who goes into the bathroom after they eat is bulimic, but I think it's just something to look at. They stay in the bathroom, they have to vomit right away after they eat to get rid of whatever they eat. And sometimes it can go undetected for years because no one really realizes what's going on. And it is reported that bulimia is much more common than anorexia among adolescent girls. The binge often consists of high-calorie and carbohydrate-rich foods. In the process of a binge lasting from minutes to more than an hour, as many as several thousand calories may be can be consumed. I think a lot of times they go on these binges. It's a lot of food at once. If this question is something about yourself, the listener, or a family member, a binge would be eating, you know, all this food very, very quickly in a small amount of time, and then the person going into the bathroom, vomiting, taking diuretics, exercising. And also over-exercising can be a sign, too, of an eating disorder. Someone who eats something and then immediately has to exercise for an hour to make sure it all comes off. I mean, everything in moderation. So I think if you yourself are starting to feel concerned, it's always listen to your gut feeling about what's going on. You know your body. You know what's going on. You know, hey, this doesn't feel right. I think if sometimes you can catch it in the beginning, if you have the awareness that something's not right, and it's hard, especially if a lot of these are young adolescents, to kind of say, you know, this is not just wanting to look good, wanting to fit in. It kind of takes over your life. It has a mind of its own. Bulimia is a psychiatric disorder, and it differs from overeating or constant snacking that some people indulge in occasionally, and some overweight people indulge in quite often. It is a disease characterized by its compulsive cycles of binging and purging, varying from several times a day to once every few weeks, accompanied by depression and other psychological disorders. Bulimics often suffer from anxiety and guilt over their inability to control binging and shame over their need to purge. Now, that's very interesting. I know a lot of people say, oh, well, then just stop throwing up or just stop eating so much food and you won't have a problem. It's not that easy. I work with a lot of clients who have eating disorders or body image distortions, and the loved ones in their life will say, you know, you really don't need to eat that. Don't eat that. You know, you don't need that extra cookie. Stop doing that. And I think family members think that's helping. That's giving them, you know, hey, don't do that. But it's actually doing the exact opposite. It is traumatizing them. It is causing them to deteriorate. That is thought of criticism. That is actually fueling them to go on the binge, fueling them, their anxiety, which will cause them to either not eat or to eat more as a bulimic and purge. It's that feeling of being in control. It's feeling of, you know, you're preoccupied with your weight, body size, dieting, food. So it's very, very serious. So if you're dealing with someone who has this, who has bulimia, who is anorexic, it's very, I know it's easier said than done, but it's very serious to make sure you're not being too critical. People take these criticisms very to the heart. This can actually be very damaging to the person who's going through this eating disorder. So we want to make sure that we always get a treatment team. And I think there's another group known to have increased incidence of bulimia is college women, whose rate is significantly higher than that of the general female population. They think the link to bulimia for this group is the women's need for achievement, their high and sometimes unrealistic expectations and demands for themselves. Also, young college women athletes seem to be at risk. Approximately 3% of 690 athletes in Midwestern colleges met the diagnostic criteria for anorexia and 21.5% for bulimia. This I got from Aerobics and Fitness Association of America, Eating Disorders, Cause and Effect. I mean, you really start to look at these numbers, and it's serious. And I know a lot of times, you know, it's not my child, it's not me, I'm just, you know, really thinking about exercise, I'm really trying to be healthy. But it can. It can really go to a very serious, serious condition. And I said that another medical conditions that come into play is the female athlete triad. The triad is composed of eating disorder, amenorrhea, and osteoporosis. And these three related problems have serious long-term repercussions for women. Really, really serious anorexia and bulimia have such an impact medically. And I think that's what can be really, really scary about what's going on, because you don't know. You don't know. Seriously, you think it starts off as, I'm just, you know, I ate too much, let me vomit, and then it becomes this habit, it becomes this everyday thing, and this binge eating can also physically causes your stomach to stretch, and that can also alter the ability to properly mix the food, and it infects your small intestines, and then also doing like the self-imposed starvation carries a lot of, and then binge eating, it's a lot of heavy abuse and heavy strain on your body, and then the types of food that you're eating, that you're purging, that really, really has a serious, serious impact. And if it's signs and symptoms, because of the relatively normal weights of bulimics, it may be hard to identify physical signs of the disorder. One obvious sign that may or may not be present is bite marks on the fingers from self-induced vomiting. I know some of this is pretty drastic and it is pretty upsetting, but I think that's really serious if you're thinking that maybe someone in your family or your young daughter is looking for those bite marks. And also, bulimia is often accompanied by depression, so severe that it can cause suicidal thoughts, fatigue, disturbed sleep, overwhelming feelings of guilt and worthlessness. And I think that's also something to really explore with yourself or with your loved one that you feel may have this. The guilt, the shame, and really figure out, what is that about? What is the guilt about? What is the shame about? It's, you know, the behaviors are very harsh, and I think it's not about judging. It's not about, you know, saying what's wrong with you, what's wrong with that person that's suffering from either anorexia or bulimia, but really to say what can be done, helping them with positive affirmations, having a healthier lifestyle, thinking, you know, feeling that they do have some control over their body, over their life, over the way things are going. And really, it's a team effort. You definitely need a medical team, a psychiatric team, a family support, friends, peer support, even going to meetings, being around other people who suffer from this. Because it's a very, very serious, both anorexia and bulimia are very, very serious diseases. So I hope I answered your question. If any more questions or want to know more about anorexia, bulimia, different types of body distortion, you can always send me an email at insightintohealing@gmail.com. All names are confidential. I will never put anyone's name up. And I will also answer the questions through the weeks on the show. Dear Insight into Healing, my 15-year-old daughter's behavior has changed significantly. She used to be very talkative and social, but now she's withdrawn. What should I do? This is really interesting. This, first of all, what should I do? I think, as you know, if you've been listening to my show, safety first. The idea that she's that significant change. How long was the change overnight? Was the change within a year? I think really looking at that, how quickly did it change? And I think sometimes when behavior changes quickly, you want to rule out if there's any drug abuse, alcohol abuse, sexual abuse. Was there a traumatic event, bullying? Was there something that caused her behavior to change so significantly? If it's taken a little bit longer and it's something you've seen through the years, I think it's really looking for a mood disorder, looking to see what's going on. Is it a depression? Could it be major depressive disorder? Could it be dysthymic disorder? And I think really figuring out what is going on. Also, is there mania? You said she used to be very talkative and social, but now she's withdrawn. Has she gone back to the very talkative? Was it, you know, really checking to see was it any type of mania, and also I think ruling out is it bipolar. What should you do? I would first talk to your daughter. I would also check to see if there's any suicide ideation, if there's any suicidal gestures, thoughts, and also if there's any cutting behaviors. I would really want to know, first check, rule out safety, make sure everything's okay, there's no suicidal issues going on. And I think also speaking with her and also seeing if she would get evaluated, go to a psychiatrist, go to a therapist, and meet and talk about this change. Major depressive disorder, that these patients have had no manic or hypomanic episodes, but have had one or more major depressive episodes. Will either be recurrent or one single episode. This I'm getting out of the DSM-4. The dysthymic disorder. This type of depression is not severe enough to be called major depressive, but dysthymic disorder lasts much longer than major depressive. There are no high phases, manic phases. Bipolar 1 disorder, there must be at least one manic episode. Most bipolar 1 patients have also had major depressive episode. Bipolar 2, this diagnosis requires at least one hypomanic episode, plus at least one major depressive. And then the cyclothymic disorder, patients have had repeated mood swings, but none of them are severe enough to be called major depressive episodes or manic. And I think for mania, people say, what is mania? This is, repeated behaviors of very high, elevated moods. It also sometimes is associated with overspending, overeating, over-sexualized, staying up for days and not getting any sleep. And I know sometimes when people are in college, they stay up, they're doing studying. Once in a while, that's not bipolar. But if you see kind of a pattern of moods, like they're very manic, they're up for days, they're getting a lot done, and then they go into a very depressed mood where, when you said she's not social anymore, she used to be social, she used to be talkative, she's withdrawn. You want to see, okay, how long has this been going on? Is this the first episode? Sometimes with bipolar, it can happen in young people when there is, sometimes I've found young adults who are going for their first year away to college. It's, the anxiety, the whole, being nervous about going away, and sometimes can be traumatic, that can also be when they have their first episode of bipolar. So you really want to see what's going on. But I would definitely, first, of course, talk to your daughter, make sure that she's safe, that she's okay, and really check with her how she's feeling. And I think also looking to see, I find sometimes you want to be careful if it's depression, is she giving away her belongings? Do you find that she's not doing things she used to enjoy? Getting rid of her books, her music. That you want to make sure is not going on. And if it is, you want to take her to see a professional right away. Depression does not obviously always lead to suicide, but I really want to, when someone's behavior changes significantly, I think it's definitely a red flag. You definitely want to take her in and to see somebody just to be safe. She doesn't mean she even has a diagnosis. It just could be something is going on, something's bothering her at school or with friends, maybe something in the home. And I think it's always great to start to have that open communication with your child, with your daughter, and to be able to discuss these things. And I know a lot of parents have come to me and said, you talk about a lot of very tough subjects on your show, and I'm nervous about talking to my teenager or my young child about it because I don't want to put thoughts in their mind. I don't want to scare them. And I see that part too. I can see both sides of it. And I think sometimes, as a therapist, when you're working with people and you see so much every day that you can kind of just jump in to what's going on and really want to explore it. So I understand. I definitely understand that these are tough, topics. These are tough discussions. I definitely understand that and I agree with you. But I think sometimes, I always do safety first, and I find that talking about something, maybe you don't have to go directly right to it, with your daughter saying, are you depressed? Are you suicidal? Getting really, but I think it's making it your own, talking to her, the discussion where you can have that open thing and say, I just want to make sure you're safe. I want to, is there something going on you want to talk about? And really allow her to feel safe and having that safe environment. And it's such a huge, huge asset, and it's such a huge achievement to be able to have that open relationship where your child can come to you and speak to you about what's going on. And I know it's hard and it takes time. This isn't something that happens overnight, but this is something that can be worked on. And I think it's also teaching your children. This is teaching your children to, when they become adults, to when they get into their own relationships, to know how to communicate, to know how to really discuss and express their feelings. So other things, sometimes, you know, people can't express their feelings, they can, and not feeling in control, as I said in the last question, anorexia, bulimia, cutting, depression, anger, anxiety. I think it's really important to have your child really feel that it's okay to talk about these things. And it's, you know, to be self-aware. You don't want them to be hyper-vigilant, but you want them to be aware and to say, okay, you know, this is what's going on. I'm concerned. My door is open. And let's talk about it. So let's go on to our third question. Dear Insight into Healing, what is the difference between compulsive eating and binge eating? This was really, really interesting. Again, I got this from the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America. And I learned a lot by reading this. It says there's a significant difference between bulimics and compulsive overeaters in the nature of their binges. Bulimic binge usually consists of food that is high calorie, not nutritious, such as sweets or junk food, while the compulsive overeater may binge on foods that are otherwise healthy, as well as sweets and junk food. In addition to binging, the compulsive overeater may continuously snack, allowing food to become his or her constant source of soothing. That's very interesting, because I think this also brings up a lot, too, when we were talking about anorexia and bulimia. Food really becomes the source of soothing, their source of comfort, their source of control, and they really started becoming a very distorted relationship with food, and it becomes really, you know, the center of their life. And I think also finding out, you know, what's the difference between compulsive eating and binge eating, and to be aware of it and to look at it. And it said weight gain is the result of these binge eating episodes in the absence of the bulimic practice of purging, or the body's ability to metabolically process these calories. It is not fully understood why some of the people who are prone to these binge eating patterns are obliged to purge themselves of the food and others aren't. So I found that very interesting, that some people will have these huge binge eating, but then they won't purge it, and some people do purge. And I think it said there's not any type of patterns or some things that, okay, why this person is prone to binging and purging, and this person is just would not purge. Some professionals believe that the reasons may lie in the psychological and sociological theories regarding the origin of the disorders. While the purging act associated with bulimia can prove highly dangerous to one's health and even life-threatening over time, obesity in all is also related to problems of health complications that plague the compulsive eater who does not purge the food. And also there's a lot of physiology concerns, the impact of how the obesity produces high levels of anxiety and stress for a lot of the compulsive eaters. So I think with the compulsive eating, if they're not binging, you see a lot of the weight gain. You see also a lot of the calories, the what's going on, and really a lot of eating. So as becoming obsessed with food, now their biggest fear is happening. They're gaining weight. They're getting heavier. So their fear of not being in control is actually getting worse. So which triggers them to eat more, to want to control it. And I think that's what it is. And it's not as easy to just stop eating or watch what you eat. It's that whole negative cycle. I find, you know, there is food addiction, as there's alcohol addiction, there's drug addiction. And I think that's the way to really look at it. Yes, this person might know that these behaviors are not healthy, that these behaviors are not something that they should be doing, but it becomes this vicious cycle that they go in order and around and around and around. And I think it's really, you know, it takes a while, as it does with any addiction, to really get treatment, to start healing, to start getting the awareness of how this started, when this started, why am I doing this, how can I become healthier? And it said here is who develops addictive eating disorders. A compulsive overeater is described as someone who eats even when he or she is not physiologically hungry. This thing can occur in people of any size. Not all people who are overweight are compulsive eaters. So that's very interesting. I think make sure, we don't stereotype that all people who are overweight are compulsive eaters. And not all people who compulsively overeat, especially those who do infrequently, are overweight. So there's not one set stereotype. You can say, okay, this person has this. So I think I want to also be careful to the listeners to make sure also that you're not self-diagnosing all the time. I mean, it's good to be aware and say, okay, I have some of these signs, some of these symptoms. Let me figure out what's going on. I think if you really start to feel like you have a lot of these signs, that your gut's telling you something is, go to a professional. Because I think sometimes I find a lot of times people can read, as with internet access and all that, you can go on and read all these different things and the symptoms and the diseases and conditions, and you can kind of say, wait, I have that, and then become, start self-diagnosing, which can be very, very dangerous. Many compulsive overeaters share the following characteristics in common. 1, a self-image based on body weight. 2, an inability to diet and lose weight or an inability to maintain a weight. 3, a strong desire to eat unrelated to hunger, feeling fat for as long as they can remember. 4, feeling compelled to eat, although obsessed with weight and dieting, using food to fill the emotional voids. That's a lot what we are talking about, is the food starts becoming, it fills the void, it's self-soothing. Even though it starts becoming an unhealthy behavior and causes anxiety, guilt, shame, purging, binging, it fills a void. And I think it's finding, what is that void? What is going on that the person is trying to avoid or feels that there's a lack of in their life? Overeating after periods of food restriction, engaging in secret eating. Now, secret eating, I think it's also fine, it's a secret because people really don't obviously know what's going on, but I think it's if you find yourself secret eating once or twice, it happens. We're all human. Sometimes we eat more than we should. That's not what I'm talking about. But I think, looking for things like, is there always food wrappers underneath your bed, underneath your child's bed? Is there food in places in the room that food usually people don't eat in their bedrooms? Or is there food hidden all over the house? Do you find remnants of wrappers, leftover food, old food, spoiled food? These are all signs you want to just make sure what's going on. Why is there food in other rooms? Is your child hiding what they're eating? Sometimes children do. They snack, they eat, they take a couple extra treats and they hide it. Don't be alarmed with that. But I think always look for patterns of behavior. How long have they been going on? What has there been any behavior changes? How is their mood? Are they isolating? Are they, withdrawing? Are they angry? Are they anxious? Are they crying a lot? Are they very secretive? You really want to see what's going on. And then using rigid control in an attempt to stop their obsessive compulsive eating. It's such, this cycle that goes on and on and on and back and forth, and it's hard. And eating disorders are very hard to work through, but it's possible. And I think going to a clinic, getting some inpatient care is really important. This is something, again, as I say a lot of times on my show, this is not something for you to do on your own. And it's not a weakness that you have to go help. And I think it's almost the contradictory, because someone with an eating disorder feels like they don't have any control. So by going and saying, I don't have any control, I need help, is almost admitting to their biggest fear. But I find that is professionally the only way to get through this, to move through this, to become healthier. And it's not a weakness to admit that we need help, that you need help. We all need help. We all need support. And I think that's what I hope through this show. I help my listeners to understand that. Asking for help is not a weakness. Providing help for others, in relation to what you can, what you're capable of, is important. Giving it back, paying it forward, being supportive of each other, and not criticizing. I find so many times people think they're doing constructive criticism and don't realize how much damage they're really doing. It's just really being there for someone, being a support system, showing that you care. It really goes a long way. For someone to have somebody to listen to them that actually, to feel that somebody cares, that someone realizes, hey, I realize you're not around in class anymore. Hey, I realize you're not coming to the computer class anymore. Hey, I realize you're not playing tennis with the group anymore. You're not doing Sunday morning brunch. Little things like that is really important to say, hey, I just want to check in with you and make sure everything's okay. Can really go a long way. And having an awareness that people really need our help. People, we're meant to help each other. We're meant to support each other. And to always, you know, to try and do that, to be there for somebody else, but always be there for yourself too. And make sure you have an awareness and that you take care of yourself. Let's go on to our fourth question. Dear Insight into Healing, my grandfather is 84 years old, and the doctor stated he does not have much longer to live. He has cancer. I'm having a very difficult time with this and feeling very overwhelmed. How do I deal with this? This is a very, very tough scenario. Unfortunately, it is a part of life, not having cancer, but having to deal with a death of a loved one, people getting older, and also when someone has a terminal illness. And it's really what I say a lot to my clients is having the grieving process. There's no quick Band-Aid that you can put on this. And I think, you know, sometimes I've worked with clients who've had a loved one who wasn't sick and, you know, suddenly passed away, to clients who've had, you know, had a grandfather, had an older family member who was diagnosed with a terminal illness and had, you know, a couple of years to live, had 3 months to live. And you kind of are living on that borrowed time, and also feeling like you never know when the other shoe is going to drop. So it is a lot to deal with. And what I say is, you know, be good to yourself. Have, if you can, get family support, get professional help, see a therapist. Spend time with your grandfather to really be with him. And I think it's also starting the grieving process. I know he's still alive. But I think it's coming to terms with that they're saying there's not much longer that he has to live. And I think allowing yourself to feel the sadness, to feel the anger, to feel the pain in a healthy and safe environment, and to grieve and to be able to say, you know, this is tough. And I think also, you know, the grieving process, there's so many different ways. There's anger, there's bargaining, there's depression. And I think it's really acceptance. Denial is going through this and really saying, where am I in this? And it's not like a certain order that you go through. They can go through it all different times, different ways. One, anger can last longer than depression. Depression can last longer than anger. So I think it's really making sure also you're not judging yourself. You're feeling these feelings and you're saying, okay, what else is there I can do? Make sure you're also doing healthy things. Is it going for a walk? Is it, you know, going to the gym? Is it reading a Bible verse? Is it praying? Making sure you're taking care of yourself emotionally, mentally, physically, to really make sure everything is okay. Because sometimes I think also when you're a caretaker, I'm not sure if you're taking care of your grandfather full-time or he's in the hospital or he's at home or in a nursing home. That, too, I find I've worked with a lot of people who are caretakers of their loved one who's dying, who's terminally ill. And that is a whole other kind of problem, or this kind of really stress on the body. And there's also a lot of meetings for people who are caretakers. And it's, you know, I think it's really understanding the seriousness of what you do. Taking care of someone, watching someone, you know, dwindle away or coming to that point, that stage of life, is very difficult. It's hard. There's no easy way to go through it. But I think it's making sure, you know, see if there's a good group around for caretakers. Because I think so many times I work with people who are caretakers. They take care of everybody else. But then when it comes to them, they don't take care of them. And they kind of push away their feelings. They push away their needs and say, oh, I don't want to be selfish. I need to take care of all these people. And then they find, you know, years go by. So they're taking care of somebody else, something else is going on, that they've never taken care of their own needs. And they're seeing some medical problems. They're seeing anxiety. They're seeing anger. They're seeing resentment, weight gain, not sleeping, all these different things. And they're kind of confused, you know, what's going on. And I think the mind and the body are very, very, they know. Like, if you don't pay attention, you don't take care of what you need to take care of, it doesn't just go away. You have to take care of it emotionally, mentally, physically. Spiritually, you have to be there and take care of it. Just, you can't kind of just slide it under the rug. And I think that's why so many times these, you know, people don't care. You know, they get diabetes, there's obesity, heart conditions, anxiety. You want to make sure that you're getting, you know, you're taking care of yourself, because you have to be healthy, you have to be strong. So I think how to deal with this, I think it's, you know, if you're not seeing a therapist or seeing someone, I would think if it's really impacting your quality of life, your functioning, that you feel like you're not, maybe you're not going out, you're feeling very depressed, it's become really a severe impact on your life, you might want to see a professional. If it's just, if you just feel like this is tough and you're managing through, I would talk to friends, I would talk to family members, I would make sure you're doing things that are healthy for you. And I know so many times people say, I feel guilty going out to enjoy myself because this person is dying and this person's in pain and this person's suffering. And I think it's not feeling guilty. You have to, you can be, you can, as I say, you can find your peace within the chaos. It's okay to maybe, you know, you're going through such a tough time and you know your grandfather doesn't have much longer to live. You know, don't feel guilty if you go out and see a funny movie and you laugh or you have a great time with one of your friends. That's okay. You're allowed to do that. I want to make sure you allow yourself to also enjoy life. There's a time to grieve and there's time to enjoy life, and you can do both. I want to make sure you're not kind of just shutting down, because sometimes when you become so kind of focused around this, and it's hard not to become so focused, but you also want to make sure, you know, you're being healthy and really taking care of yourself. And I think that's why I don't know if you have any brothers or sisters or are there any other family members that are around that you two can talk about this. That's why I also said you're going to a caregivers meeting where you can also hear other people's stories who've gone through something similar, who have the same feelings, and to know that these feelings are normal. People feel this way. You're not the only one this is happening to. And I find so many times people get stuck in something and they feel like I'm the only one who goes through this. It's really such a huge weight off your shoulders to be able to hear, not that other people are suffering, but to hear that other people have gone through what you're going through and that they've made it through. Of course, it's upsetting. It's never going to be a happy time. But I think to be able to know that there is that light at the end of the tunnel, that you can heal from this and that there's hope. And that's what's really important, is to keep your hope, to keep your faith, and to keep your focus, and just to make sure you really take care of yourself. Well, let's go down to our last question. Dear Insight into Healing, my boyfriend of 2 months used to contact me at least 10 times a day. And now, all of a sudden, he can't talk during the day. He's really busy. Is there something wrong? This is a very interesting question. Anytime I find there's a drastic change in behavior, it raises a red flag. And I want you to make sure you said, is there something wrong? This might not have, and this is going to sound strange, have anything to do with you, even though he's not calling anymore, he's not contacting you anymore. This might be something that's going on with him. And it's very hard to kind of pull yourself out of it and take that side and say, okay, let me not look at this in a personal matter, but in an objective matter. So I think, is there something wrong? I think kind of maybe go through your mind, going through some of his behaviors. Did this happen overnight? Was there any traumatic event? Is there any communication problems? Is this what he does when he is, was there a recent argument, or was he not feeling good about something? Is this a behavior that happens, that he shuts down, that he avoids? And I think you said you've been your boyfriend of 2 months. I tell a lot of my listeners, when someone shows you who they are, they usually show it in the beginning, listen to it. This is something, and this might not be anything. There might be something going on. That's why he isn't contacted. But I think you need to ask him what's going on. And so many times people say, oh, I don't want to cause problems. I don't want to bring it up. I don't want to seem like I'm nagging. But this is, this is a big change. This isn't just something like, hey, you forgot to say goodnight, or you didn't. This is pretty serious. I mean, for someone that calls at least 10 times a day and then all of a sudden can't talk anymore, something is going on. And as I said, it might have nothing to do with you. This is something that's going on with him. And I think this is something also to keep in mind. And I know this is tough. Is this someone you really want to spend a lot of time with? And I think, is this a pattern? Is this how he reacts to things? And if it is he willing to work on it? Is he willing to acknowledge it, one? Or number two, is this a deal breaker for you? Can you deal with this? I mean, if this is how it's going to be every time you get into a fight or anytime he feels that something is wrong, even if you don't even know that, it sounds like you don't know, is there something wrong? I mean, you didn't say if there was an argument or something else happened. If this is just coming out of the blue, this is something you want to say, is this how he deals with things? Because usually how people deal with things and how people react in the beginning is they're giving you a glimpse of who they are and what they are. So it's really saying, is this something I can deal with? Is this a deal breaker? So I know it's tough. I would call him. I would want to speak to him in person. Don't do it via text. Don't do it, you know, through the email. I think, you know, there's no more face-to-face anymore. Everything's social media, texting, you know, Facebooking. This is something I think I'd want to sit down with him and have a conversation with him and say, hey, I've noticed this is going on. Is it something I should be concerned about? And kind of see if he's open to talking about it. Also, this might be, you know, you've been together for 2 months. Maybe he's not feeling open enough or being able to feel vulnerable to tell you what's going on. Maybe something happened at work. Maybe there's some family problems. And that's okay, too. If he's not ready to share that with you, that's okay. He doesn't have to tell you everything he's thinking, what's going on, and everything about him. It's only been 2 months. But I think he does owe you to say, listen, you know, something's really upsetting me. I just need some time to myself. I'm sorry. When I'm ready to talk about it, I'm ready to talk. That's okay. So I think it's like you don't have to get all the answers and know everything, but you also don't want to be totally shut out and kind of, is this going to be a pattern that every time he gets upset, you have to wait a couple of days until he calls you or until he contacts you? You want to make sure, I think it's also, you know, since it is a new relationship, it's starting to set boundaries. It's starting to set guidelines on how you want your communication. What are the boundaries of the relationship? How you expect and deserve to be treated, and how you expect, how he deserves and expects to be treated. And I think it's, I know it's hard in relationships, especially in the beginning, to start negotiating these tools and these ways of interacting. But it's very important. I think so many times people just let things slide. They, oh, hopefully it'll change. You know, this will get better in a couple of months. You know, if you don't work on something, if there's not an awareness about something, some things can just kind of work themselves out. But I think when it's such a significant, all of a sudden he can't talk during the day, he's busy, something's going on, it's saying, okay, what happened? Is he even aware of what happened? I think sometimes, you know, it's so obvious to us, oh, he used to call me 10 times a day, now all of a sudden he can't talk. He might not be that aware of the drastic change. And I know it sounds like, how could he not? But I think it's, you know, if everything else seems okay in the relationship, it's definitely something, you know, I wouldn't wait to talk to him about this. I would bring it to his attention and just say, hey, you know, I'm just concerned. I realized, you know, I just saw the significant drastic change in behavior. Is there anything I can do? Is there anything you want to talk about? Are you upset? What's going on? Because I'm feeling kind of shut out and confused and taken by surprise. And then let him talk. And let him see what's going on. Why does he behave like this? Is this something he always does? Is this something new? Is this something with that he can talk about and work through? If it was something about an argument that you two had, and you know, is this something you two can come to a compromise on? Is this, you know, can we talk about how do we move forward after an argument to make sure? Yes, I know it's hard to sit down and talk to someone when you're arguing with them. But to also have boundaries and guidelines of healthy ways to fight, healthy ways to argue, so you know how to negotiate these different interactions. And I know it's easier said than done. It's a tough conversation, and it's hard to have these conversations when you're in the middle of something, when you're angry, when you're sad, when you're upset, to sit down and say, okay, let me think rationally how to do this. So I think these type of conversations don't happen in the heat of the moment. I do a lot of couples counseling, and I say, you know, when you're in that heated moment, when you're really angry or really upset, that's not the time to really kind of make your demands or to negotiate where this is going or to make any decisions. Because then as we're in those emotional states, we make decisions that maybe 20 minutes later when we calm down, we wouldn't have said that. We wouldn't have acted that way. So we really want to make sure when we are talking, when we are expressing how we're feeling, that we do it when we're calm, when the dust has settled, when we're feeling more in control of our mind, our thoughts, our behaviors, our words, so we don't say or do anything that's really not appropriate that we're going to feel guilty about. Because, you know, people say, oh, he knows I didn't mean it, or she knows I didn't mean it. It's just, you know, that's what happens when we fight. We want to make sure we're not hitting below the belt. And, you know, just because you're angry, just because you're upset at the other person, doesn't give you the right to say really nasty things, to say anything you want, you know, to hurt them because you're hurt. And I think I see so many couples that it gets down to that. And you know what? Yeah, maybe you don't think that person means it, but it still hurts and it sticks with you in the back of your mind. So really be careful what you say when you're fighting, when you're upset. Try to have some control over it. I would say give it 10, 15 minutes, walk away, and come back and discuss it when you've calmed down. And you usually will have, you'll see things differently through your eyes. So I think with your question, is there something wrong? I would say something is going on. I'm not saying there's something wrong with you. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the relationship, but there's something going on. I would definitely, talk to him about it. See if he's okay with it. See if it gets any better. See next. And I think it's only, after one event, you really have to see patterns. I think look for patterns of behavior. And that will tell you, is this something that just happened? Was this a fluke? Or is this the way he deals with conflict, with problems, with everyday life? And then decide, is this a deal breaker for you? So let's go to our journaling exercise before the end of our show. This exercise tonight is start to declutter your life emotionally, mentally, and physically. Why I chose this is I feel the questions that we had tonight for the show hit emotionally, mentally, physically. And I think having those three areas in your life and learning to declutter, to sort them out, to kind of process. And it's not just get rid of things, it's processing. Because as I said before, if you just throw something out quickly and you don't kind of sit with it, have awareness to it, it doesn't go away. So you want to emotionally get your feelings. What are those feelings do you find? Do you feel that you're pretty content with life? Do you feel like there's always anger? There's always jealousy? And sit with it and explore it. Mentally, what are your thoughts like? Do you find that you're always having negative thoughts? Are you always seeing the worst of everything in people? And kind of sitting with that and saying, okay, when did this start? Why am I feeling this? How does this serve me? And going through that. And then physically, is there stuff in your house that is cluttering? Are you keeping things that aren't healthy for you anymore? Are you able to give more space for new things? Are you able to kind of get rid of the old and bring in the new in a healthy way? Are you holding on to things? Do you get rid of things too quickly without thinking? Are you impulsive? And I said, really explore those different areas of your life. And I think by doing that, mentally, physically, emotionally, you're clearing out to be healthier. You're clearing it out to be happier, to be in a better place in your life. And it's all about kind of hitting those three areas of your life and creating harmony in all of them. So again, thank you so much for listening tonight. If you have any questions, please send it to insightintohealing@gmail.com, or you can go to our Facebook page, Insight Into Healing, and give us a like and private message me, or you can even leave a question there on the page, and I will answer it. And thank you so much. And the song that took us in was Every Good Thing by The Afters. The song that's going to take us out tonight is Today's the Day by Charles Scopoletti. Good night, everyone, and God bless.
Living my life, taking the steps to become better one day at a time. 'Cause I know there's a bigger picture, reach for the stars. 'Cause I know that I get there, and don't be a dream crusher anymore. I know I'll be something great, and I don't negativity. Today is the day I'm living my way. Say all the things I wanna say. Embrace the possibilities. We only have one life. Live it to the fullest inside. I'm giving my all. Even when I am tired and I just not fall, but I get up and I keep trying. No, you can't take my will, 'cause it runs deep inside me. Don't be a dream crusher today. But I'm living. become better one day at a time. 'Cause I know there's a bigger picture, yes, I reach for.